day to consider supporting WBAI. Consider becoming a sustaining member for as little as $10 a month. Of course, you could pledge more than that if you're able to do so. Our pledge line is open. It's always open 24 hours a day. Give us a call now at 516-620-3602. Once again, that number is 516-620-3602. Become a member, become a sustaining member, or a major donor. Whatever you can do to sustain this radio station in the center of the FM dial here in New York City. It's 9 o'clock. And on Thursday mornings at 9 a.m., we bring you Equal Rights and Justice with Mimi Rosenberg. Please stay tuned.
Equal Rights and Justice, where we educate, agitate, and organize to empower we, the people, for another world is possible, and we are the ones to make it so. I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Later on, anti-abortion, pro-insurrection. We'll look at how opponents of the right to choose played a key role in the January 6th uprising in the U.S. Capitol. And then, hidden in plain sight, we'll surveil those unimpeachable offenses just as dastardly and summarily skipped over. But first, insurgent supremacists, the U.S. far right's challenge to state and empire. We're joined by Matthew Lyons, who's been studying and writing about right-wing politics for over 25 years and focuses on the interplay between right-wing movements and systems of oppression and responses to these movements by leftists, liberals, and the state. Matthew, how do you define the groups that participated in the attack on the Congress January 6th? And do you see a sea change overall in their practice related to the philosophy or issues of the assumption of state power in that attack?
The forces that were involved in the attack on Congress were supporters of Donald Trump and more specifically supporters of the fraudulent claim that he won the election. These included people with a variety of different ideological persuasions and members of different organizations, but they shared that overarching position in terms of the election and what should be happening with the government. As far as a change, it certainly was a dramatic event that's unprecedented in terms of U.S. history. I see it as reflecting a real shift among a major section of Trump supporters. Up until the presidential race of 2020, Trump did a lot of scary and appalling things, but he mostly worked within the framework of the established political system. It was only with the growing sense that he might lose the race that he started to increasingly put out the claims about election fraud and engage in efforts to disrupt the election. When it became clear that he had in fact lost, that's when we saw basically a shift into completely rejecting the validity of the results and basically saying the voting system as practiced is a fraud. And this is a claim that was supported by literally tens of millions of people in the United States, if we can trust the polls. To me, this is a real sign that a very large section of the right has at least temporarily moved from being prepared to work within the existing system to calling the legitimacy of the existing political system itself into question. That then was further crystallized by this physical mass attack on one of the core governmental institutions in the United States. And it really points to the prospect of significant political violence and conflict ahead.
There's a manipulation to empower oneself of the Trump administration, of the forces of the alt-right, the far-right, the extreme right, the revolutionist right. I'm wondering if it's less the manipulation of Trump of them or the kind of sophistication and move to white nationalism and move to fascist ideology that manipulated and used Trump in the ascendancy and growth of these groups over the last 4 years. Do you think there's any shift that really occurred in these groups prior to the assumption of the presidency by Trump that we need to be concerned about?
It's important to see Trump's relationship with the various far-right forces as a dialogue, as a back and forth, rather than simply Trump as the leader and they as his followers. There are different forces within the far-right that have had different relationships with Trump. So the alt-right, for example, which I would characterize as a particular subset of the white nationalist movement that has tended to be focused on internet activism. The alt-right played a major role in Trump's 2016 electoral campaign, and I think really helped him in a major way. In the years that followed, many alt-rightists became very disenchanted and disappointed with Trump because they felt that he had really let them down, failing to deliver on his promises of moving forward elements of their agenda. And in their view, Trump capitulated too much to conventional conservative goals and priorities. So, for example, around focusing on shifting the tax system to make it more regressive and prioritizing corporate interests rather than prioritizing their racial goals. Other sections of the far right continued to remain supportive of Trump, so the Patriot movement and other groups we associate with the citizen militias, and much of the Christian right remained much more closely aligned with Trump. But it's true that it's not simply that Trump was leading and they were following, but rather they felt that he was continuing to act in ways that were supportive of their agenda. So, you know, Christian right forces advocates really creation of a full theocracy. They want their version of Christianity to control the government and you know, control society as a whole toward a, you know, authoritarian theocratic system.
As we look at the advent of these groups, the QAnon now, etc., that we really have forgotten that there hasn't been a disappearance of the Klan, of the John Birch Society, of the inherently white supremacist groups that still seem to me to be the foundational groupings from which these their progeny, so to speak, have sprung. Is that a fair analysis?
There's both a continuity and some important differences. The Ku Klux Klan or various Ku Klux Klan organizations are still around. and other kinds of white supremacist organizations are still around. There have been changes in the kinds of ways that those groups operate and the ways that they relate to the state. So Greensboro massacre in 1979, perpetrated by members of both Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazi groups against members of the Communist Workers Party and other leftists. That was an operation that was actually organized with the help of a federal agent, an undercover agent for the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and a former for the local police who had also worked for the FBI. So it was a real dramatic example of state collaboration with white supremacist paramilitary forces. In later years, some of the white supremacist organizations shifted dramatically into a much more oppositional stance and called for revolution against the United States, actually took up arms in some cases against the U.S. government in order to create a separate white homeland. So that's a significant shift. In addition to those far-right forces that are rooted in that kind of tradition of explicit white supremacism, you also have seen the rise of other kinds of far-right forces that have different versions of racist ideology. So, for example, that espouse colorblindness, the idea that we, quote-unquote, don't see color. This is a different kind of ideological support for racial oppression in the sense that it denies racial oppression and therefore helps to protect and further it. You also see the rise of other kinds of supremacist ideologies that are not centered on race. So Christian theocratic forces played a role in support of Trump, in the January 6th assault on the Capitol, and in many other far-right initiatives. They tend to focus much more on issues of gender and sexuality than on race, repealing abortion rights and reproductive rights, scapegoating, demonizing, and criminalizing LGBT people. These kind of efforts, they're not mutually exclusive with white supremacism, but it's a different focus.
I'm wondering if this is what fascism looks like. The assumption of state power now, is that a dominant strategic consideration for many of these more coherent, developed groups and possibly where they begin to have some sort of tactical, if not strategic, alliances towards fascism looks like American style?
There is certainly a concern among many sectors of the far right around how do we gain state power. As in the past, there are different strategies around that. I mean, David Duke represented a kind of electoral strategy, certainly had a disturbing degree of success. I mean, in at least two statewide elections in Louisiana, he won a majority of white votes. Others within the far right, and specifically among white nationalist forces, have focused more on an armed strategy. A dramatic example of that was the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing by neo-Nazis that killed 168 people. I would certainly say that many of the groups or that have been involved in the recent activities around the Capitol and related shows of force have at least many of the elements of fascist politics, trying to ease control of the state, using it in the service of, you know, some kind of larger project for racial transformation, or, you know, I think you could, there can be other versions of that, that, as I said, are based on, you know, a religious vision or something like that. And you do definitely see some elements within, for example, the January 6th forces that espouse this kind of a larger vision.
While we can see the interplay between Trump and these forces on the far right. We now have the Josh Hawleys, we have the Ted Cruz, we have the Mike Pence, certainly coming from the Christian theocratic side of totalitarianism. There are state actors there, financiers in the form of the Koch brothers and many others who are financing ultra-right reactionary groups. What I'm wondering about, we are not focusing on people who are part of the plutocracy, whether the financiers and or forces in government, which would certainly be a large swath of the Republican Party that are certainly enablers. Looking at this attack on the Congress.
There's definitely cause for concern. I mean, as with Trump, if we're talking about the Republican Party more broadly, you know, or other kind of prominent figures within the Congress or the U.S. government, their relationship with the far right, I mean, there is definitely an interplay there that is, it's one of the dynamics that has fueled developments that we've seen. It's a back and forth process. It's not simply a matter of Ted Cruz or, you know, the other senators sort of leading the way and then the rabble out in the streets following. It's more of a back and forth. And so it's the question of relationship between extra parliamentary or, you know, non-state political forces that have their interests and their agenda, and then forces within the state, and how do they relate to each other? And in some instances, they will, you know, really help each other out, and there's a kind of a symbiotic relationship there. And in other cases, they will be pulling in different directions and may conflict, and that's going to vary. I think in broad terms, certainly the trajectory that the Republican Party has followed over, you know, really the last several decades has tended to move to the right in broad terms and also to expand the space that's available for forces and ideas that are even further to the right than the GOP itself or what is considered acceptable among elected officials. It's a kind of a feedback process that goes on there, because then as the forces further to the right develop, then they also pull the elected officials further in their direction, because somebody like a Ted Cruz, he got outflanked by Donald Trump in the 2016 primaries and was not expecting to be challenged from the right, but he was. And so he wants to make sure that that doesn't happen again. As far as the plutocracy side of things goes, here too, it's important to look at the relationships between wealthy individuals and corporations and, you know, in broader terms, you know, let's just say it's sections of the ruling class on the one hand, and the kind of grassroots and non-state and non-corporate far-right forces on the other. There, you know, you can certainly find instances where capitalists have funded and otherwise fostered and supported far-right initiatives. I think it would be a mistake to see that as the driver of those forces, but I don't think it's simply that they are working at the behest of capitalists or something like that. I think, again, it's a conversation. It's a question of finding mutual common ground. And it's also important to recognize differences and divisions. So, I mean, you mentioned the Koch brothers, for example. The Koch brothers have been one of the leading backers, or, you know, when they were both still alive, David and Charles Koch, among the leading backers of hardline right-wing politics in this country for a number of years. But they were not supporters of Donald Trump. They disagreed with Trump about his hardline immigration policies. They also disagreed with his trade policies. Doesn't mean they were on our side, but it you know, it points to the kind of divisions that you can have even within scaring right-wing forces.
Historically, we've certainly looked at the issues, what I consider one of the most important eras and one of the most democratic in the history of this country, such as Reconstruction, and it's in its aftermath to destroy it, the lynching, Jim Crow movements that evolved to destroy any form of people of African ascendry ascending into state power, assuming, you know, carrying out self-determination. We see the rise of McCarthyism in response to anti-communism or in response to the worldwide, at that time, growth of communist ideology and efforts to support decolonization and the like. We've seen it certainly in response to the Obama administration. There was the backlash, and there is, of course, during any period of immigration, a virulent right-wing revolutionist ideology of xenophobic nature. And again, we've seen that in terms of the strong threads of anti-Muslim sentiment more recently. Clearly, these threads of right-wing revolutionist extremist activity is been part of the history of this country. I have some concern about treating the events of January 6th as novel rather than a kind of part of the continuum. As we wind up, the agenda for progressives, is it that we have been remiss in really attacking and tackling and weeding out a white supremacy, misogyny, xenophobia, transphobia, and anti-gay sentiment? Are these part of the responsibilities and conditions that we have not addressed that has also been allowed this cancer of extreme right-wing virulent behavior to become so prominent at this point?
I think part of the challenge for people on the left is, you know, on the one hand, we see the rise of these kind of far-right forces and, you know, an upsurge of supremacist violence and demonization of various kinds. That's a significant threat just in and of itself, separate from everything else. It's an immediate danger to members of many communities, and, you know, it's something that demands a response. At the same time, those forces exist in a context of an overall society that is deeply unjust, profoundly undemocratic. It's characterized by all kinds of systems of social hierarchy and oppression and economic exploitation and all of these things, many of which are embraced by people who are not part of the far right. The struggle isn't just on one front. I mean, there is a need to confront the forces of the far right, and there is also a continuing need to address and attack the overall systems of oppression in this country, even when the forces that are running those systems are claiming to embrace the mantle of anti-fascism and anti-extremism and so on. It makes for challenges in terms of, you know, what kind of alliances do we form? What kind of coalitions do we form? How do we relate to efforts by forces within the state to crack down on the far right? I think there's a dangerous temptation to see this, you know, the state security apparatus as some kind of protector. It would be very dangerous to support efforts to build up state repression in the name of anti-fascism or in the name of fighting the far right. Combating the far right is something that has to be based in popular mobilization, in struggles that are based on liberatory politics, and not in the establishment institutions of the state repression, which are ultimately in the service of tiny elite rather than democracy and freedom. So it's a challenging, complex problem, but it's something that we also have. There have been some really valuable and hopeful signs. I mean, just you look at the kind of dynamic activism that people engaged in over, you know, this past year with the mass movements and uprisings against white supremacy and against police violence. You know, there's a lot of lessons there that we can learn and draw inspiration from. If you look at some of the mobilizations against Trumpism and against the alt-right, which were very successful years back in shutting down people like Richard Spencer and other white nationalists. There's a lot of lessons and inspiration we can draw from these. So it's not all bleak. There are really some powerful precedents and examples that we can build on.
Matthew Lyons, thanks for joining us. And listeners, do pick up a copy of Matthew Lyons' Insurgent Supremacists, the U.S. Far Right's Challenge to State and Empire, and its accompanying study guide. Now, award-winning journalist Eleanor Beda, pundits eager to dissect the origins of the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol rarely include the misogynist anti-abortion movement in their music, but they should. The attack on Congress in their meeting hall, the Capitol, following suit of the what you describe as the Rambo-like clinic invasions we saw in the late 1980s and early 1990s.
That was actually a quote from a clinician who has been working at the Southern Tier Women's Center in upstate New York for decades and decades. But a lot of what we watched on TV felt like the rescue, like people who couldn't care less about anyone else, who were just really excited to be able to do something really violent and really physical and menace other people. They seemed to take great joy in making folks afraid of them, and that seemed to mirror both the Capitol insurrection and some of the worst of the anti-abortion activism of the 1980s and early 1990s. Operation Save America was present at the Capitol. I don't know that any of them were among the people who were breaking windows and were actually going into some of the offices and wreaking havoc, but they had a worship service in front of the Capitol right at the rally site, right after Trump spoke, and they were doing their usual number about how abortion is murder and the reason that the world is in such a sorry state is because of gay marriage and because men are marrying men, women are marrying women, and women are having abortions and killing the next generation. But their ideology is often really focused on white women having abortions, and there's always been a thread that we're killing our own. The United States is going to be overrun by them unless white women reproduce in massive numbers.
And what do we really know of whether there were prominent anti-abortion groups and individuals in attendance at the gathering? You did mention Operation Save America.
Right.
Is there a sense of who those people from that organization was and whether or not there were other really outspoken anti-abortionists? Or is the issue what we know of groups like the Proud Boys and what we know of the Three Percenters, QAnon, and so many of the other groups who we do understand had members in attendance and are virulently anti-feminist, anti-reproductive rights, and so on?
We know that Operation Save America leaders, at least three of their most prominent leaders, were actually at the Capitol because they posted on their Facebook page about what they saw and how excited they were to be there and how well-received they were by the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers and all of the other groups that were there, because they said that people really responded well to their message. In addition, there were quite a number of pretty well-known anti-abortion figures. Operation Save America is the group that formed out of the dregs of Operation Rescue. So it's been around for about more than 30 years. But there was a woman named Abby Johnson who at one point worked for Planned Parenthood and then saw the light, found God, and became an absolutely crazed anti-abortionist who actually spoke at the RNC this summer. Another person who was there, and there's footage of him, is John Brockhoff. John Brockhoff tried to bomb several clinics and served time in jail for a clinic attack where he literally bombed a Pensacola, Florida clinic in the 1980s and served several years in jail for that. He was there. And they're a diverse movement, and the anti-abortion thread runs through a lot of this, but of the groups that were specifically anti-abortion, Operation Save America was probably the most visible and the largest presence at the Capitol riot.
We haven't mentioned any of the Christian identity movement groups that have long been virulently anti-reproductive rights, anti-abortion. Do you have any sense of what their involvement is? And really the lessons that seem to be there in virtually all of the groups as a feature, as a mainstay, as an element of their very existence on the alt-right, and that is absolute misogyny, control over women.
That thread runs through everybody who was there, whether male or female, and that thread really unites a bunch of different ideologies. It's virulently misogynist, it's virulently homophobic, and it's virulently anti-reproductive justice. So add in racism, add in anti-immigrant sentiment, and some of the other ideas that they hold, and it's a pretty wide-scale political worldview. One of the people who's been studying this for many decades, a professor from Kentucky named Carol Mason, said that this was one of the first times that she had ever seen the crossover, so that you had folks who were primarily anti-abortion merging with groups that were primarily Christian identity, with white supremacy groups, with homophobic groups, all of them coming together in common purpose to wreak havoc on the Capitol and show AOC and the squad that they were a force to be reckoned with. I mean, it was no coincidence that she felt really fearful for her life, that Ilhan Omar texted her husband and said, you know, tell the kids I love them if I don't make it home. I mean, really heartbreaking stuff, but these folks really felt like their lives were in imminent danger because of how much hatred they felt being thrown their way.
And how important is it to see that ideology, which is not as prominently on display as it should be from the forces of opposition to the takeover of the Capitol? What does it say about the threat as a whole to women's reproductive rights at this particular juncture?
That's something really sad, because very few of the mainstream pundits or news reporters actually looked at the misogynist thread or the anti-reproductive thread or the homophobic thread. They instead focus exclusively on the white supremacist thread, which obviously white supremacy is horrifying, and that they're right to pay attention to the anti-Muslim attitudes, to the anti-Semitism, to the anti-people of color attitudes. But the picture is broader than that, and not taking into consideration misogyny, woman-hating, and homophobia is a real mistake, and it means that we don't get as full a picture of who these folks are as we should have.
Talk to us also about, for example, groups like the U.S. Taxpayer Party and a number of the other groups on the extreme and far right who people may not have heard about. Their dominant philosophy and activity is directed at the abortion rights movement, at reproductive rights being determined by women, of women's control over their bodies. Let's name some of these groups and flesh out what their perspectives are.
A lot of the anti-abortions have their roots in more broad-scale politics because of what was then called the U.S. Taxpayer Party. They later changed the name to the U.S. Constitution Party, that they would prosecute any abortion provider and basically prosecute them for murder if they were elected. So obviously the anti-abortion movement, in large part, joined up with the U.S. Taxpayer Party and stayed with them when they became the Constitution Party. That movement came together thanks to someone named Howard Phillips, who was a big New Right heavyweight of the 1980s. He formed the party in the 1990s and was its presidential candidate in 1996. That candidacy, obviously he didn't win, thankfully, but he was able to bring the anti-abortionists into that broader political worldview, which opposed the United Nations, opposed NATO, was virulently homophobic, was, as I said, would prosecute abortion providers as murderers, probably would have done something horrible to women who had abortions, although they didn't campaign on that. It was a way for the anti-abortion movement to broaden its ideological framework so that it wasn't just abortion and sexuality and homosexuality that they were opposed to, but it gave them a broader political worldview, and it tied them in to the new right of that particular era, which is now going strong. I mean, some of the organizations that were formed in the new right, groups like the Heritage Foundation, are still going strong, and 25 or 30 years in are very well funded by people like the Koch Foundations, Koch Industries, and are able to do a tremendous amount of damage because they are so well-funded and so well-connected. And the anti-abortion folk, especially those in the most violent wing of the anti-abortion movement, are very tied into all of those organizations that were once called the New Right.
Talk about Dr. Carol Mason, who's a professor at the University of Kentucky, who has monitored and written about anti-abortion movements for at least two decades, and emphasizes that there is an inherent overlap between white nationalist, violent anti-abortion, and anti-government movement.
I also want to stress, not every anti-abortion person who's anti-abortion is part of this at all. I'm talking specifically about the most violent wing of the anti-abortion movement. These are the people who, on Saturdays and weekdays, stand in front of clinics no matter what the weather and harass the hell out of women who are going into the clinics, staff at the clinics, the escorts of people who are going into the clinics, and have really made life an absolute living hell for anyone who goes into a clinic or works in a clinic. You know, that group has been not only harassing of people, but they've also often engaged in violent acts, like the man I mentioned earlier, John Brockhoff. But for that particular strand of the anti-abortion movement, those three are really central to their worldview, and you can't have one without the other. So being anti-abortion and being anti-big government, as they call it, are part and parcel of the same agenda, the same thing.
So you're saying distinctly that there is a correlation between pro-insurrection and anti-abortion.
Absolutely. Well, again, not every strand of the anti-abortion movement supports what happened on January 6th, but there are enough who are, you know, if you think abortion is murder, act like it's murder kind of people who are very militant, who want to stop abortion by any means necessary, and they are teaming up with some of these other players to enact an anti-abortion agenda, but also go much farther than that and align with white supremacists, align with homophobes, align with anti-Semite down the line. And they are making, whether it's a strategic unity or if it's ideological unity that they all truly hold fast to, is impossible to know at this particular moment, but it's certainly enough that strategically they're banding together and they're forming an alliance that can do a whole lot of damage. I mean, they're going to be back in D.C. on March 4th when they think that Trump is going to be inaugurated. I don't know. I don't quite get what the plan is, but they do think that Trump is going to be ascendant on March 4th. I don't know why March 4th, but you can set your watch to it that there will be a ton of these people showing up in D.C. on the 4th and exerting their muscle.
To what degree, given your research, your politics, in terms of historic lessons, is there that intrinsic element of misogyny and control and abuse of women as to their being able to live their own lives and to do so with complete self-determination, whether it's their physicality or their intellectual prowess being realized and utilized, is really anti-abortion, control of women, misogyny, an imperative, a necessary and dominant characteristic of fascism and neo-fascist movements historically.
Yes, but they're also very proud of the women who have become ascendant. So Marjorie Taylor Greene is in Congress, and that's okay. They're not telling her to go back home and knit booties for, and make more babies. They're happy that she's there so that some women can ascend. And they're championing those women. But, you know, by and large, yes, the misogyny is really deep. And even among the women who are ascendant because they're towing the line, they're anti-abortion, they're homophobic, they're anti-Semitic, they're racist. They're basically taking the ideology. And the movement has shifted enough to allow a few women, at least, to become leaders in that movement. Although I'm sure most of the men are not that excited about taking orders from a woman, they will strategically. Again, that may break down. There may be fissures in that movement that divide those men who say, no way, no how am I going to listen to some chick. But there are also going to be some who are open to listening to Marjorie Taylor Greene and who are not put off in any way by the fact that she's a woman in Congress.
Thank you so much for being with us. And do tell us where we can read your latest article.
You can read progressive.org, which is the Progressive Magazine's daily blog. The blog is available online, and you can read it on a daily basis.
Eleanor Beda, thank you for joining us and lifting up this very critical point that has been, I wish I could even say camouflage, but it just hasn't been there, and it must be. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Old pirates, yes, thereof I sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my head was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? All I ever had, redemption songs. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy. None of them can stop your time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Well, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill Jabo. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? All I ever had, redemption song.
Now Norman Solomon, National Director of RootsAction.org and the author of many books, including War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death, joins us to talk hidden in plain sight, the unimpeachable offenses the Congress never asked about.
A lot of the catastrophes that have occurred in the last 4 years could have been prevented with impeachment when it first was appropriate, which was literally on the first day that Donald Trump became president.
The first day that he became president, obviously the grand descent on the gilded moving stairwell. Is that what you're talking about in the commentaries that were so xenophobic, so offensive about Mexican immigrants?
From the outset, I'm really talking about the moment when he took his hand off the Bible and was inaugurated president. There is the Domestic Emolument Clause of the U.S. Constitution, and there's also the Foreign Emolument Clause of the U.S. Constitution. He was in violation of both of those as soon as he became president. There were many weeks before that moment when he was warned that the Constitution forbids the president from being enriched by actions that government, the U.S. government, would take in relation to other governments overseas, as well as federal government actions that the president would personally financially benefit from in terms of policies and financial activities of the U.S. government or any of the states. He completely refused to do anything to comply with the U.S. Constitution, so no one is above the law. And yet, by failing to move to impeach Trump from day one, the U.S. Congress was essentially saying this president is above the Constitution, which is supposed to be the supreme law of the land.
We were able to see finally in subsequent years 75 million people vote for Trump. So what would have been the efficacy, really the possibility of doing what you're suggesting? Isn't that an extreme position that is counter to efforts towards bipartisanship that seem to be prevalent, at least theoretically?
Either the Constitution should be adhered to or it shouldn't. And when you've got the most powerful person in the U.S. government at the beginning and from the outset being able to function with impunity, then it sets the pattern, the mold, which is replicated again and again. In the piece that I just wrote, I quoted then minority leader of the U.S. House of Representatives in 1970, the Republican Gerald Ford. He said this: what then is an impeachable offense? The only honest answer is that an impeachable offense is whatever a majority of the House of Representatives considers it to be at a given moment in history, unquote. Well, so then you're in a realm of, to what extent is there a political calculation made that high crime and misdemeanor has been committed by the president and therefore the president should be held accountable? And I think in the case of Trump, as in the case of other presidents, and I've written in this piece as well about President Bill Clinton, Richard Nixon. Nixon, of course, resigned under threat of impeachment. Clinton was impeached, where they were guilty of many crimes that made it appropriate for them to be impeached. They were not, and in Nixon's case, the articles of impeachment that were drawn up by the House Judiciary Committee did not address them. So if you look at Trump, there are literally dozens of impeachable offenses that he committed, beginning with his violation of the emoluments clauses of the U.S. Constitution. Don't have time to go into detail of even most of the different ways that Trump violated the Constitution. Early on, as president, Trump was inciting violence. He interfered with voting rights. He discriminated against Muslims, discriminated on basis of religion, prosecuted illegal wars. He threatened nuclear war. He abused the pardon power. He obstructed justice. He politicized prosecutions. He had failed to respond to the hurricanes Harvey and Maria. Trump also separated children and infants from their families, certainly in moral and hopefully political terms. That would be an impeachable offense. He illegally attempted to influence an election. He engaged in tax fraud. He assaulted and denounced freedom of the press. He supported a coup in Venezuela. He unconstitutionally declared emergency. And we know that he instructed the Border Patrol to violate the law, to brutalize immigrants. He refused to comply with subpoenas, went ahead with illegal proliferation of nuclear technology. These are just a couple dozen of the articles of impeachment that at rootsaction.org, where I work, we drew up, and we, in real time, posted and publicized these. Some of these were no mystery to members of the U.S. Congress, including Democratic Party leadership, but for years and years, top leaders, Steny Hoyer and Nancy Pelosi, they just didn't want to go there. So, you know, it depends on whether it's going to be simply a political expediency calculus or whether we're going to believe that the law and the Constitution really mean something.
Certainly means something to, I dare say, people like you, myself, and our listeners. But the question is, aren't these really more their political offenses? They're not per se, or do they rise to the level, as far as you can see, of legal offenses? Isn't really what you're talking about the fact that we haven't been able to in the progressive movement really launched the political offensive during all this time, that there really has been a capitulation on the part of the Democratic Party, on the part of the neoliberals, to the agenda, the policies and practices of Trump, and that it's not really a matter of impeachment.
Well, impeachment is a symptom, and it's about power. Gerald Ford was being very candid in 1970. He said it's whatever the House considers to be, at a given moment in history, an impeachable offense. There is no legal standard. That's always been the case. It's about politics. It's about power. It's about values. Certainly one of the key values is whether the president or anyone is above the law. It's a marker for whether you have a democratic society, lowercase d, democratic, or whether you have an autocracy or you have a system of authoritarian rule. If it doesn't matter if the president of the United States obeys the law, then you get on exactly the slippery slope that we've been on. And one thing, it's sort of a cascading effect one to another. You know, going to that underlying point is when progressives, when those who believe in the rule of law and genuine equality for all human beings, when we gather enough power, we make a difference in a positive direction. In the absence of sufficient power, then you get people like Trump who are able to do what they can do, and you get many people of the Republican and all too often the Democratic parties who violate and are willing to be part of violating basic human rights, who are indifferent to the suffering from people who lack health care, education, housing, indifferent to the refusal to even get a declaration of war while bombing people in one country after another. So it is about power. Some people quote Marx, some people quote Engels. I would quote Humpty Dumpty in Through the Looking Glass from Lewis Carroll, when Alice asked, how can you make one word mean so many different things? And he said, the question is, who is to be master? That's all.
Doesn't that really take us to the issue of that there should have been a mass people's tribunal that put him on trial for all of these abuses to the human condition in a myriad of forms? So are these really legal matters, or is there really a kind of nascent critique of the progressive movement, who did relatively little during the 4 years of the Trump administration to bring to bear their numbers to protest?
Well, most people wearing a legal hat would say that it is the enshrined legal process in the Constitution and the laws of the United States that have to be activated. It certainly isn't one or the other. Whether you're going to have a people's tribunal or mass demonstrations in the streets or media messaging that reaches tens of millions of people, some of which we have really had in the last several years, that's all to the good. I don't think it's an either or whatsoever. Mm-hmm. There certainly was a lot of opposition to Trump on a lot of grounds, including from some mainstream Democrats, but most vigorously from the left in terms of principled progressive pushes back to resist, to oppose. It still comes down to power. And I think that's where you need to build movements outside the electoral arena, and you need to fight inside the electoral arena, because ultimately, whatever you're going to be protesting in the streets or denouncing polemically and with information flow and media networks and so forth, at the end of the day, you're demanding that changes happen in government policy. And those changes are going to be acceded to or ignored and resisted and rejected by people who are in the House, who are in the Senate, who are in the Oval Office. You need to push back. You need to organize. It's ultimately about power. And I think we can't choose between organizing at the grassroots outside the electoral arena and fighting to elect certain people, lobbying, and if necessary, causing the impeachment of others through the legal process. I think we need to do all of it.
Isn't this really what you're asking for, an indictment of the system? Because while the articulator of many of the most onerous and offensive policies that you talked about might have been Trump, aside from the offensiveness of the form that Trump's discourse, the neoliberal regime that is fundamentally the Democratic Party, I don't believe would find terribly offensive. Most of his foreign policy, his trade policies, and so on.
I think a lot of immigrants, a lot of people who had their benefits cut for health care or food stamps or whatever, they're not going to say it didn't matter whether he was president or a Democrat was president. At the same time, I think there's a lot of truth in what you're alluding to. On foreign policy, I think we could split the foreign policy and say in some ways it is making a profound difference. In some ways, it's making no difference whatsoever about Trump. In the latter category, you know, you have a new president, you have Biden in, but the nuclear weapons $1.7 trillion plan for so-called upgrading nuclear weapons, that is there. There's support for NATO now more rhetorically, but it's pretty much been ongoing. There are a lot of ways we could calibrate, and the military spending budget, that's going to be very similar. At the same time, the effort apparently to go ahead and reinstate the Iran nuclear deal, rejoining the Paris Climate Accord, renewing the START treaty for nuclear weapons with Russia, these are some different policies compared to what Trump was pursuing. Progressives have two overarching responsibilities. One is to fight the right wing, the xenophobes, the racists, the misogynists, the nativists. That has to be fought at all times. At the same time, we need to fight the neoliberal agenda. We have to say that we have a progressive vision, and we're not only fighting against the white supremacists and all the rest of it, we're also fighting for a truly humanistic progressive program. And as you allude to, that often means we have to be in direct conflict with the Joe Bidens of the world. We have to organize to challenge the neoliberal model and to say another world is possible.
And would you say that this latest impeachment effort, was there both a tactical and strategic mistake on the part of the Democrats not to add all those other substantive things that you referenced earlier to the charges against Mr. Trump?
In terms of these two impeachments have been brought about against Donald Trump, in the political climate, I hate to say it, Mimi, it sort of makes sense, because these Democrats who run the party, with the exception of the squad and some real progressives, but the dominant power of the Democratic Party in Congress is very shallow. And they're just looking for political expediency and openings. So when Donald Trump violates the emoluments clauses, when he threatens violence, when he issues an illegal threat of nuclear war or abuses his pardon power, there's almost nobody home because they don't see an opening. So we could second guess the way these impeachments have been brought forward against Trump, but there really was not the kind of heft or determination from Democrats to make much of anything else stick, I'm sorry to say.
Well, I really want to thank you for taking us to the point of acknowledging that there are other impeachable offenses that have gone by the wayside, and for asking the questions that our Congress has not asked and challenging us to take up in our own tribunals with our boots on the ground, and yes, to push whatever tools there are that we can use, including members of the Democratic Party, to come up with an agenda for a better world as possible. Thank you for all the work you do, and I strongly encourage people to check in with rootsaction.org for a true anti-militarist, anti-war perspective, and a perspective that is there for humanity. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. We've been speaking with the National Director of RootsAction.org, Norman Solomon. Do consider picking up a copy of his War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. For Equal Rights and Justice, I'm Mimi Rosenberg. Stay strong and stay well.
Everyone is fighting for equal rights and justice. Palestine is fighting.
You're listening to WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Equal Rights and Justice with Mimi Rosenberg, Thursdays at 9 a.m. It still comes down to power. And indeed, another world is possible. We're a commercial-free and listener-supported radio station. Listener-supported. Think about that. For 60 years, we have been so, thanks to listeners just like you. For a program like Equal Rights and Justice, I'm going to ask you to do what you know you should be doing right now, supporting this radio station, WBAI. You can make a contribution of any amount. Do so right now. Call us. The pledge line is open, and the number that we want you to call right now is 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602 for Equal Rights and Justice.
Hey, this is Smokey Robinson, and you're listening to WBAI